Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome to the roundtable webinar on M&A and PE in India, Legal and Tax Insights, Emerging Structures and Strategies. This roundtable and webinar is being organized by Nishit Desai Associates in association with the Singapore Business Federation, Association of Investment Bankers of India, Thai Singapore, Singapore Venture Capital and Private Equity Association, and the American Chambers of Commerce in Singapore. The speakers are Vivek Katpalia, Partners and Head of Singapore Office, Nishit Desai Associates, Nishal Joshipura, Partner, Private Equity and M&A, Nishit Desai Associates, Ruchir Sinha, Co-Head, Private Equity and M&A, Nishit Desai Associates, Mahesh Kumar, Head of International Tax and Globalization, Nishit Desai Associates, Singapore. Ankit Mishra, Senior Member, Private Equity and Mergers and Acquisitions, Nishit Desai Associates. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Also, you can download our mobile applet, Nishit Mobile, which is available on the App Store for iOS device, Play Store for Androids, and BlackBerry World to access the current updates and videos. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand the session over to Mr. Vivek Katpalia. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
All that is gone, anyway. We're all following so many different developments in the world, emerging markets slowing down. We've seen the Chinese stock market crashing and then government support coming in and trying to prop it up. Brazil, commodity prices, oil prices crashing. So it's been a very turbulent time economically. We've seen the U.S. Market rebound, talk of interest rates going up. But in the middle of all of this, if you look at the Indian economy, there are signs of stability after a very long time. Now, yes, things in India do take time, but at the same time, if you look at the volatility that other markets are presenting, except U.S., India still provides a great opportunity for investment. And I think this has been we've seen the activity, the M&A and the private equity activity, increasing substantially, even from 2014 onwards and the first half of 2015. Just to give you some very brief snippets. We had about 277 deals and in the first half, M&A deals in the first half of this year itself. And that's a pretty large number, $15.8 billion. So, of course, in India, M&As are not $1 billion per acquisition, but cumulatively it's about $15.8 billion in the first half. Similarly, in private equity, there are some sectors which are very hot. Valuations have skyrocketed, but investment is still coming in, e-commerce obviously being one of them. We've seen a large number of investment, about 462 deals, $7.1 billion. Again, a staggering number. Many of our clients are doing deals on a fortnightly basis, investing in various types of startups. So IT, e-commerce, life sciences and healthcare, and banking and finance, I think, are sectors where there is a lot of activity currently. But at the same time, India does have its own challenges, and occasionally we are requested and required to come up with very innovative structures because we have exchange controls. There is a ever-changing tax environment in the country. Every day you will read something or the other, the latest being P-notes. You have MAT. You have the India-Mauritius tax treaty, what that is to do with Singapore. So a lot of dynamics which keep changing, but few positives. Political stability. We have a government that is quite stable. We know they'll at least be there for 5 years. So they have a 5-year period to try and push through some of their reforms. Currently there is a deadlock in Parliament because of various political reasons, but we expect that to ease as time progresses. Weaker global markets, especially other emerging markets, again, are an advantage for India. A lot of the investors are looking back at investing their money in India. Of course, we have a long-term potential growth as far as our domestic market is concerned, large, middle class, all these things that you already know about, and believe in sustained liberalization. So what we've tried to do, we have five of us on the panel, my colleagues from India, as well as Mahesh, who's with me in Singapore, and we're going to try and, I'm going to moderate them. I'm going to ask them a number of questions on some of the most interesting innovative deals and structures that we are currently working on. We'll have a Q&A session at the end. At about 4:10 is when I'm going to try to end this so that we have about 15-20 minutes for Q&A, people on the phone as well as people on the, in the audience, followed by a networking and high tea outside. So I think we'll start the panel now. Let me start by introducing Mr. Joshipura. He's come from Bombay. He's my partner. He heads our mergers and acquisitions and private equity practice. He's very, very active currently on advising a number of our clients who are doing very complex, large deals in India. And these clients are from all over the world. So, Nishal, I think to kickstart our discussion, we've talked about innovation. We've talked about deal structures. What's new in the sense... What are you doing which is different from what maybe people know that we were doing a year or two ago? Is there anything that is truly innovative in deal structuring in India today?
I think there are a lot of things, given the fact that India is a complex place to do business. The regulatory and the tax system is not that simple as you'll find in some of the other countries. At times, there are issues on predictability of the system or the law which has been drafted by the parliament because the interpretations which are taken by the tax department and by the regulators sometimes don't go with what has been drafted in the legislation. Given this complexity, it is important that, you know, any deal that is being structured, we have to find ways to ensure that the commercials with the parties have entered into are achieved. And that's how we come up with innovative and creative structures to ensure that, one, the parties achieve what they wanted to achieve, and second is on the enforceability side also, which is a very critical part because unless your structure is enforceable, it has no meaning. Just having a creative structure is of no use if you cannot enforce it. So few things which we have seen in the last few years on the listed space and in the unlisted space. I'll share some of the structures that we have seen. In the listed space, as some of you may be aware, India has a takeover code where if there is an acquirer who acquires more than 25% of a listed company, he is obligated to make an open offer to the public shareholders to the extent of additional 26%. Now, what we have seen is in certain situations, this 26% which needs to be paid to the public shareholders is the leakage for the acquirer because actually the money doesn't go to the company, nor does it go to the selling shareholders or the promoter. So one of the structures we have seen to avoid this open offer type of situation is the listed company does a business transfer of the key business in which the acquirer is interested to one of the Indian companies of the acquirer. When you do this, there is no takeover code which applies because takeover code applies only in a situation where securities of a listed company are acquired. So if the listed company is selling its business to another Indian company which is owned by the acquirer, then there is no open offer that is required. So to that extent, the acquirer saves on the 26% consideration which needs to be paid to the public shareholder. Now, off late, we have seen a lot of these type of deals happening. The major one being Piramal and Abbott deal, which happened 2-3 years back, where Piramal Healthcare sold its healthcare solutions business to Abbott. And one of the reasons why this lump sale or the business transfer structure was followed was to avoid the open offer. So this is one structure which we have been seeing. One of the other creative structure to avoid open offer, which we have seen recently, is the Spice Jet case, where there was a scheme of reconstruction which was sanctioned by the Aviation Ministry, and that scheme of reconstruction was considered as the reason for claiming exemption from making of open offer. Now, this is the first time in the history of the Indian Takeover Code that a scheme of reconstruction has been used by any acquirer to claim exemption from the open offer. And this is again quite unique. There has been a lot of debate amongst lawyers and consultants on whether the scheme of reconstruction in spirit, does it qualify for the exemption and the open offer. But till date, SEBI hasn't come back to the acquirer, and it seems that they have digested the fact that they are okay with the scheme of reconstruction for the purpose of granting exemption from the open offer. One of the other innovative transactions which we saw last year, which actually had ingredients of multiple transactions in one transaction, was acquisition of Sterling Holidays by Thomas Cook. This was a transaction where we saw all types of M&A transactions clubbed in one transaction. So there was a secondary purchase of shares from the promoter, from the sellers. There was a preferential allotment, so the money went into the company. There was an open offer component, so the money went to the public shareholders. There was a market purchase, where there was a block deal which happened on the market. That was another one. On top of that, there was a demerger and there was a merger. So almost 6 to 7 components of any M&A transaction all were part of the same transaction. So it was a very uniquely structured transaction which happened last year. So what we have been seeing is the complexity of the deals is increasing. There are a lot many creative and innovative structures which we have been seeing on the listed space. One of the other things which we have been seeing of late is the structured deals for promoter financing. Last year, when the stock prices were not that great for many of the listed companies, the promoters or the founders of the listed companies wanted to increase their stake through creeping acquisitions. But they didn't have funds to do that. So one of the structures that was used a lot was what we call promoter funding structure, where the private equity investors used to fund the holdco of the promoter or the founder. And that money was used to increase the stake in the listed company, with the returns of the private equity investors linked to the stock price of the listed company's shares. So that's another thing which we see in one of the other deals which we did last year. The way we funded was we did an offshore funding structure for helping the promoter acquire certain shares in the open offer. So there was a joint control type of situation which was there, and the promoter was funded by the acquirer to acquire shares in the open offer, and there was also a rights issue which was going to be there. So in the listed space, these have been the transactions which we have seen, which have been quite innovative in the last 1 to 1.5 years. As far as the unlisted space is concerned, one of the major trends which we have been seeing is externalization or flipping of Indian companies outside India. One of the reasons why a lot of Indian companies want to flip outside India, or rather flip the ownership of the Indian company outside India, is the listing of that company becomes very simple. Today, although the government has allowed Indian companies to list abroad without any listing in India, there are a lot of complexities attached to it, and that's why what we have been seeing is the Indian company's shareholding is replicated outside India in a foreign company in a jurisdiction like Singapore or Netherlands. And that company is then taken public on NASDAQ, NYSE or LSE, depending on the sector in which that company is there. So that's one structure which we have seen. Of course, there are many other advantages to it. In cases where the business of Indian company is export-oriented, it makes sense to have an offshore holding company, because you are also avoiding the exchange fluctuation risk, and India has gone through a lot in the last 2 to 3 years on the exchange fluctuation, where the dollar has moved from almost 40 rupees to 60 to 63. So there has been a huge depreciation in the value of Indian rupee in the last few years. So to avoid that exchange fluctuation risk also, this model of flipping the Indian company outside India also has worked quite well. one of the other things what we have also noticed is when you flip an Indian company outside India, the funding from the banks also is available at a cheaper rate. So if you're borrowing in India, you may be paying north of 11 to 12% interest rate depending on the sector in which the borrowing happens. As compared to that, if you're borrowing abroad and your business is predominantly export-oriented, in that situation, you are able to borrow at a very cheap rate, LIBOR plus few basis points, and LIBOR itself is at very low right now. So the funding cost also reduces a lot. So this structure we had actually implemented for one of the large Indian company, which is now successfully operating from an offshore jurisdiction and has got multiple investors in it and could be going for an IPO in the next couple of years at a huge valuation. The last structure, which we have seen in the unlisted space is, as all of you know, India has three regimes for foreign investment, what we call FDI, foreign direct investment, which is more for strategic investors. There is an FVCI regime, foreign venture capital investor, which is more for private equity type of investors. And there is an FPI, foreign portfolio investor regime, which is more for public market investors, typically the hedge funds. In case of an FDI type of investment, there is a requirement that any investment made under FDI regime has to be compulsorily convertible into equity or equity. So you cannot have any redeemable instrument issued by an Indian company if the investment is made under the FDI regime. So one of the structures which we have been using in the last couple of years is to use a foreign venture capital license, because that license allows the foreign investor to invest even in optionally convertible redeemable instruments. And one of the biggest issues with foreign investors have been facing in India is to get their money back. Even if the Indian company has money, how do you get that back? Because at times it becomes very tax inefficient to get the money back. There is a dividend distribution tax which has to be paid. Now the government has also imposed a buyback distribution tax, buyback income. So in case Indian company is buying back shares of a foreign investor, just like in case of dividend, there is an income distribution tax which is levied on the Indian company to the extent of 20%. So to get money out of India in a pure equity structure has become a bit tax inefficient, and that's why if you have an optionally convertible redeemable instrument, you can redeem the instrument and still get the benefit of tax exemption under the treaty jurisdiction from where the investor has come in. So this is one interesting structure which we have been seeing and has helped a lot some of the private equity investors who are looking at doing structured deals in India. Similarly, foreign portfolio investors have also been allowed to invest in listed bonds of Indian companies which have been placed on a private placement basis. That structure, Ruchir will deal in more detail later, but that structure again gives a lot of flexibility because on one hand you have a redeemable instrument, but at the same time you can structure equity type returns on that redeemable instrument. So it gives best of both worlds. It's on one hand a debt which can be redeemed at any time, and on the other side, if there is any equity upside on the investment, the same can be taken back through the listed bond structure. So broadly, these have been the innovative, creative structures that we have seen in the listed and the unlisted space.
Thanks, Nishal. I think just to add, the other thing that, of course, India has been focusing on is ease of doing business. Remember when you talked about the FPI investment and FPI investment FVCI. One of the issues that a lot of foreign investors faced in India was trying to understand the various sectoral caps that exist as far as investment in Indian companies are concerned. So you have these three regimes, and in some of the sectors there were sub-limits. So an FPI could only invest up to X percentage, FDI investment could be to Y percentage, and therefore monitoring all of this and to see where the trigger was being hit was becoming quite cumbersome, and it was a bit of companies were not very interested in trying to deal with this. So, and it was also adding to our ranking being very low in ease of doing business. We are ranked about 150 odd. Singapore is ranked number one, and we have the government has put a target of bringing this to the top 50 in the next year or so. So a lot of small changes are taking place on the ground. While You'll always read in the newspapers and reports that mega reforms, land acquisition, GST, yes, these are very important and they will happen. But we are seeing a lot of small tweaks happening, which is making it easier to do business. And the latest one is removing these sub-sectoral limits. So now we have a composite cap. So it's very easy now for an FPI or for an FDI investor, for an FPCI investor to know exactly what limit they have in specific sectors, except in defense and in banking. They've permitted composite FDI in almost all sectors. So I think that's made it easier. Yeah.
Just to add to what Vivek said, the genesis of this clubbing of the FDI and FPI limits was that under the FPI regime of SEBI, a foreign portfolio investor cannot acquire any unlisted shares. So what used to happen was sectors like commodity exchange, power exchange, where there is a 26 plus 23% FDI limit, where 26% FDI limit was there and 23% was FPI limit, but these exchanges were unlisted. So to that extent, the entire 23% limit was unutilized because these are unlisted exchanges and FPIs cannot buy unlisted shares. So they realized that on one hand, there is so much of demand for the 26% piece of FDI. On the other hand, there is so much of supply, but there is nobody to take because there is a regulatory hurdle where FPIs cannot buy unlisted shares. That's why they club these two limits of FDI and FPI. So now, even if you are not an FPI, as an FDI, you can go up to 49% in these sectors, which earlier was not possible.
Right. Thanks for that. So I think so. A lot of these changes are happening on a daily basis. But maybe Ankit, I can ask you a question. So Nishal has told us about some of the new innovative structures. India is obviously a very unique country as far as deal making is concerned. Many other countries in Asia have similar unique issues. But according to you, what would be some of the most important issues and possibly deal breakers that you've seen in M&A and PE deals in India? What is it that is unique as far as India as a country is concerned?
Thanks, Vivek. To understand the issues that India faces, one needs to understand India itself and the nature of companies that are there in India and what are the issues that crop up because of these nature of the companies and the people who are manning these companies. And therefore, to appreciate these issues, I must throw some light on this background. Now, unlike the Western economies where you have large financial investors, private equity investors, dispersed shareholding, India has, most Indian companies have a controlling shareholder, which is commonly referred to as the promoters. Now, these promoters are mostly reluctant sellers. Either the company is in a distressed situation or the promoter needs finances for some other reason. So they have certain emotional connect to the asset. Which is not the case if you are looking at a private equity investor. So therefore, to understand the regulations that are there in India and to understand the issues, it's very important to understand who the sellers are, the profile of the sellers. And that's why we find in several deals, where foreign investors get fairly frustrated with the long-drawn negotiations that take place. But I think one needs to appreciate that you're dealing with a seller or an asset which are sort of emotionally connected and have been so for many years. And therefore, we always try and tell our good friends in Western economies to be patient and to deal with such situations in a different manner, which you would not be used to if you were doing a deal, say, a cross-border deal between Singapore or the U.S. So therefore, those things needs to be kept in mind. Now, just to be sort of specific and something which flows from these macro situations in India is the level of diligence that you would have to do. Now, if you were buying an asset in the U.S., which is professionally run, professionally managed, backed by a reputed private equity investor, the nature of diligence you would do is very different. Whereas in India, the kind of diligence that is done around the asset is entirely different. And, it's not just on the target, it's also on the seller, who's the controlling shareholder. Now, in the last few years, we have seen a level of sophistication insofar as even the Indian controlling shareholders are concerned. I think because of the influence of private equity investors in India, the sophistication that even Indian promoters have in negotiating and finalizing the deals has really improved. Insofar as diligence is concerned, there are a few things that we continuously see. One is a growing emphasis on checking the corporate governance of the entity concerned, and that is increasing more and more. Doing a background check on the promoters is, again, something that's sort of being done. And, in fact, we have seen that deals where corporate governance standards are not up to the mark, those deals have either it's acted as a deal breaker in very minimal cases, but definitely has prolonged the negotiations in such deals, because a foreign investor is not willing to take up an asset, especially if it's a listed company, where the corporate governance standards are not up to the mark or what is expected in the host jurisdiction. The second big point that one needs to note is the value leakage. Now, what do I mean by that? Because there is a controlling shareholder, and mostly Indian companies, the way it's structured is the supplier, if it's a manufacturing company, what one sees is that the supplier or the main supplier is, in fact, nobody but the controlling shareholder. Or the brand is housed in an entity which is completely owned by the promoter and then licensed out to the target. Now, in such situations, when an acquirer is acquiring an Indian asset, the acquirer must be mindful of the fact that what are these value leakage propositions that exist in the target and must address these leakages. Otherwise, there would be significant challenges going forward. What are the different kinds of related party transactions, for example? In one of the most famous deals that happened last year involving a UK acquirer and an Indian company, it was in the liquor industry. There were several challenges surrounding integration issues because of this controlling shareholder and the promoter group model that exists in India, the corporate governance norms are heavily tilted towards the minority shareholders. And what happens is, let me take an example. You have a situation where there is a related party transaction that needs to be undertaken. Such related party transactions would have to be approved by the majority of the minority. Now, look at it from an acquirer's perspective. Now, one of these acquirers, the UK entity, wanted to acquire this asset, and one of the key reasons, commercial rationale for acquiring this asset, was to integrate its current distribution chain in India with the distribution network of the target. Now, when the deal was struck, it was struck on that basis, but after the deal was closed, when the acquirer went back to the shareholders to get approval for these related party transactions and integrate the business, the minority shareholders, in fact, did not approve that related party transaction. Now, that causes serious synergy issues. One of the key ingredients why you enter a deal is suddenly, you know, fallen apart. And those considerations, I think, need to think through those laws that exist because of the current model in India. The other issue, obviously, in sensitive sectors is around control. Now, there are sectors such as insurance, defense, aviation, where the control, though the foreign investor is allowed economic participation, there is the issue that the target must be controlled by resident Indians. Now, the entire issue, and globally this is an issue, and more so in India because the way the foreign exchange laws are worded, the definition of control is widely worded. There is no except the fact that if you own majority control or you have majority on the board of directors, you would control the company. There is no bright line test as to what constitutes control. Now, so tomorrow, if you were to buy a 24% or 26% stake in a company, the question is, you know, what rights you can have, what rights you can't have, because there are three regulators you would primarily deal with. And who have their own interpretation of control. In fact, if it's a sector where there is a specific definition of control, then you could have a sectoral regulator. For example, in insurance, you have Securities Exchange of Board of India, which is equivalent of the SEC in the US. You have the Antitrust Authority, which is Competition Commission of India. And you have the Foreign Investment Promotion Board, which looks at and approves investment in some of these sectors. And you have then the sectoral regulators. Now, each regulator has its own understanding of what constitutes control. In fact, we had a very peculiar situation last year where in the aviation industry, there was a deal that was struck. The Securities Exchange Board of India took the view that there was no control. The Foreign Investment Promotion Board also took the view that there was no control, because if there was a control, you could not make that investment. However, when it came to the antitrust authority, suddenly the antitrust authority found that there was control. And the deal, the consummation of the deal got delayed because the Securities Exchange Board of India reopened the case, because if there was control, then there was the question of open offer, which Nischal referred to, right? So therefore, these issues, you know, have been plaguing deal making in India. These are not insurmountable issues which are acting as deal breakers, but certainly prolonging the entire process. But if an acquirer were to think through this issue at an early stage, then you could address these issues better. The other aspect on the regulatory front is obviously the growing influence of the antitrust authority. Now, Indian antitrust authority has been in existence for the last 3 years, but they have had a major influence in how deals are being made and how deals are being consummated. The first is obviously the timeline issue involved with it. Now, you know, if there is a certain threshold that's met, then you would need to make a filing with the Competition Commission, and it affects timelines. But the larger issue, you know, in strategic deals is one needs to be mindful of the fact very early on whether the deal is likely to have an impact on competition in India. And if so, then the acquirer must be mindful of the fact that it may have to make certain divestitures. Now, in a bid situation, this becomes extremely critical, because if the board were to evaluate two deals, then certainly the board would have to, in certain circumstances, not only be guided by price, but also by deal certainty. And one of the aspects could be, you know, whether one of the bids has an antitrust aspect to it. So that is also something that, you know, the acquirers have to be sort of mindful of. I think the last couple of points is, and this is, again, unique to India. India has many community interests. So a lot of deals which have a community impact are not only going to be scrutinized by regulators, but one needs to be mindful of the fact and not be surprised if somebody, in fact, moves the court under something called a public interest litigation, which has happened in one of the cases that I referred to in the aviation industry. So that is also something that needs to be managed. You know, as with all other jurisdictions, PR also plays a very critical role in India. And because of this public interest litigation that is open, though courts generally refrain from entertaining such litigations, one needs to be careful, especially dealing in sensitive sectors. I think last point is on the everything comes at a price. Now, as Vivek said, India has seen political stability. There is a real argument on the demographic dividend out there. There's a long-term economic, you know, impact, and it's probably going to be the driver for the global economy in the next couple of decades. Be that as it may, obviously the downside to this is the valuation. Now, India is not cheap by any stretch of imagination, and I don't think you would want a lawyer to comment on that, but it is certainly not cheap, and that's what we hear. Now, if that is the concern, that the biggest challenge that lawyers face is how to address this valuation mismatch, because you have a reluctant seller or you have a founder who believes his company is worth a certain price. The acquirer believes that the asset is worth a certain price. How do you bridge that mismatch? Today, the way the regulations are worded, the way the foreign exchange laws work in India, it's quite difficult to sort of address some of these issues. Though we have seen structures, you know, we have evolved certain structures which bridge this gap. But, you know, like, for example, earnouts. Today, the way the regulations are worded, for a simple earnout, you would have to go to the Reserve Bank of India, which, you know, has its own challenges. So, therefore, these are some of the issues that, you know, I thought I'd highlight. Happy to take sort of any specific questions that you may have after the discussion.
Thanks. I think, as you can see, whilst opportunities are great, there are a number of structuring and documentation aspects that you need to keep in mind when doing a deal in India, including, I think, very interestingly, Ankit pointed out the uniqueness of dealing with Indian promoters. I'm sure it's similar in certain other Asian countries, but a number of times when we are asked by our clients in Singapore about a particular deal that they're doing in India, we do spend a lot of time trying to figure out how involved is the investor going to be on the ground in India. Number of times you'll notice, and we've noticed, that an investment is made, the show is primarily run on the ground by the Indian promoters, and then that leads to number of issues as far as the business is concerned going forward, mismatch of expectations, etc.
So I think that's also a very critical aspect to keep in mind. What's your on-the-ground involvement? In fact, I tell my clients that the CFO test, which is the CFO should be yours and shouldn't belong to the promoter. And you know, if you can meet that bar, of course, depends on each transaction, how much you're investing, etc. But that's really a good test to try and achieve. Another point before I come to you, Mahesh, on tax, and I hope you will make it a little interesting and not as dry as tax is, but big corruption in India has come down, and I can say this with confidence. In the last year itself, we have seen a drastic reduction in what we call big corruption. Of course, petty corruption here and there still plagues us, plagues a lot of countries in Asia. But the massive corruption that we saw, there is actually a, you know, small things. I'll give you an example. Previously, if you wanted to get and talk to someone in the Foreign Investment Promotion Board to get his view on something or her view on something, it would be next to impossible that you would get an appointment. Next to impossible. Unless you knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody, and then, you know, maybe you got time and you went and waited for 1 hour and then they met you and they gave you no answer. Now it's the other way around. We are getting calls from the Foreign Investment Promotion Board as lawyers that your client's files are pending with us. You haven't provided us this information. Can you please send it to us quickly? Because we need to show the FDI numbers going up. Because if the FIPB approves the investment, that's when the statistics go up that India is getting more FDI. So things have, on these levels, things have drastically changed. And in fact, we are running now behind our clients to ensure that information gap is being filled. So it's a good change. It's not a change. I mean, it's a change that we welcome. There are a lot of changes in tax as well. Of course, we won't go into all the nitty-gritties, but Mahesh, maybe you want to touch upon some of these nagging issues on withholding tax, indirect transfer. Has there been any solution to it? Have things, you know, settled down? What about these indemnities that people keep talking about?
Yeah, thanks, Vic. Not sure if I can make tax interesting. But again, like death, it's inevitable, so we have to deal with it, right? So tax, yes, continues to be a pain point when you have deal negotiations, whether it's M&A, PE, right? So let's take a very typical, simple scenario. You have a buyer, an acquirer in Singapore, acquiring shares of an Indian company, it's a secondary sale, and the seller is a Mauritius company. It's part of, let's say it's a PE fund. It's a Mauritius company seller selling shares of an Indian company to a Singapore-based acquirer, right? And Mauritius company says there is a Mauritius tax treaty and the Mauritius company has a tax residency certificate, and so the gains on the sale should not be taxed in India. It's quite simple, right? So, and there's so much case law in India saying that, no, it should not be taxable. But is that okay for the acquirer? So when the Singapore company is acquiring, is that okay? Because we all know today litigation risks in tax are massive. And when you're talking about tax demands, you're talking in terms of billions of dollar demands today. In fact, the tax demands in India are higher than what you see anywhere else in the world. Right? So litigation risk is a big issue. Now, the acquirer, when we acquire, here you have the Singapore company, which is the acquirer. As the acquirer, it is required to withhold tax if there was any tax payable. But then the Mauritius company says, no, there's no tax payable. Now, how does the acquirer protect himself? Indemnities have now become a market standard. But then, what type of indemnity? When you're negotiating a tax indemnity, it can become quite tricky because I've seen in some cases, some deals, just the tax indemnity clause running to 10 pages, which is crazy. It's a waste of everyone's time, but you can't help it, right? So, and what do you cover in a tax indemnity? Because the first question is, what's the scope of this indemnity? What should it cover? Yes, it should cover the tax amount. There's a lot of question on how do you, first of all, sometimes how do you quantify the amount of tax? Sometimes, you know, depending on valuation, then Ankit said, right? Because there's always, the tax department says that the asset is valued at so, and then we say that, no, it's valued at something else. So indemnity should cover the tax amount. Then, there's, of course, there's interest, and then there are potential penalties. Penalties for non-compliance in India can go up as high as 300% of the tax amount, right? And then there's also a matter of litigation costs. And then when you're negotiating a tax indemnity, assuming that there is a potential litigation, the acquirer is dragged into litigation, how is the litigation going to be conducted? Who controls the litigation? You cover all of that. Another very important question when you negotiate a tax indemnity. Here you have this Mauritius company providing, which is the seller providing the indemnity, but it's just an SPV. right? So does that provide enough comfort to the acquirer? No, acquirer may want a back-to-back comfort from the parent. The parent may be another Mauritius company. It may be a Cayman fund, right? This is a private equity fund, right? So who provides the indemnity and providing the getting that back-to-back confirmation is becomes quite important. And it also is important from the perspective of the company giving the indemnity. Let's say this Mauritius company now gives this indemnity. It's a PE fund giving an indemnity. The problem is the fund has to close because once you the deal is done, you have to return money to your LPs. You paid out your carry, right? You want to close your fund, but then you have your outstanding obligations. So this becomes a big discussion when you are doing deals, right? When you are looking at the scope of the tax indemnity, how feasible is it for parties to comply with that over a period of time? Because in terms of the period of indemnity, today the limitation period that the tax department can initiate litigation is as high as 16 years for cross-border, right? So that becomes a challenge. So indemnities have become a standard in all PE M&A deals, and of course, negotiating it is quite tricky. But it's something that is a part of every deal, along with indemnities and other strategies. Sometimes, if let's say, like in this situation, you know that the seller it's just an SPV entity, it's going to close down, but the fund has to wind up. You need more certainty, right? You need to have the flexibility, let's say, to wind up the structure, let's say, in the next 2-3 years. So one option is obtaining an advance ruling. So you would build that into a deal where as soon as the deal closes, the next day the parties file an advance, seek an advance ruling. An advance ruling is a determination by a very high-level body in India on the tax consequences of the transaction. And once they give a determination, it's binding on parties. Right, so at least that way, let's say you should get an advance ruling within 6 months to 1 year. Once you get an advance ruling, then that provides all the comfort that you need, and then it's binding on the tax department. So advance rulings are sometimes integrated into the indemnity or at least the deal framework to provide certainty on tax. And then, of course, you always get back-to-back legal opinions on availability of treaty relief and non-applicability of the withholding tax and things like that. So these are the areas. So tax is a challenge. But there are ways, there are strategies to ensure that we get maximum certainty out of it. And, of course, and there are other, as the deals get more and more innovative, newer tax challenges arise. Like, for example, Ankit was talking about earnouts, right? So as part of the deal consideration, the promoter also gets the payment over a period of time. How do you, what is the nature of that payment? Tax department says it is salary. So though it is a consideration for a sale, the tax fund is it's employment income, right? So that means someone has to withhold tax on it. Or when do you withhold tax? The payment, the deal is concluded today, but the earnouts are over a period of time. Do you withhold all the tax today? There's a lot of litigation on these points, right? So these are the things, discussions which we need to encounter when we do deal negotiation.
Just to add to what Mahesh said, currently we are facing a lot of situations for vintage funds which were set up in 2005 to 2007-8. Typically, the life of a fund is about 8 to 10 years. So most of these funds are nearing end of their fund life. And they are also exiting, either by sale to a strategic investor or sale to another private equity fund. The biggest issue which these guys are facing right now is the life of the fund is only 2 to 3 years left. On the other hand, for tax indemnity, as Mahesh said, for global transactions, the period is 16 years. For if you are selling shares of Indian company, the period of limitation is 7 years. So on one hand, your fund life is only 2 to 3 years. On the other hand, tax authorities can come after you for a period of 7 years. How do you bridge that gap of 3 to 4 years? How do you make the buyer comfortable? Because under the Indian law, the buyer is required to withhold tax before making any payment to the seller. And that's where, in addition to advance ruling, couple of other things which we have seen is tax insurance, which the limits keep on getting released depending on the availability. But tax insurance has been a great way to bridge this tax withholding gap between buyer and the seller. Another thing which we have been seeing at times, even the demands are very unreasonable from the buyer, is for the GP to give indemnity for the fund. And no GP wants to take liability for the fund. There are also requests on clawback from the LPs that, we want letters from the LPs that, they will claw back the amount of tax indemnity in case the tax liability gets activated. So a lot of interesting discussions we have been having these days, both representing on the buyer side and the seller side, on how to address the tax indemnity issue.
Stop talking.
No, stop. Thanks a lot, Mr. I think quickly we can go. We've talked about equity. We've talked about some of the structures. We've talked about tax. What has gained prominence and popularity in India recently has been debt. We are seeing a lot of foreign debt coming into the market instead of equity. And there are a number of innovative structures that have come about where the advantages that investors are getting by using these instruments is far more significant than a plain vanilla equity investment. So you have hybrid instruments, you're having a mix of equity and debt. So maybe, Ruchir, you're doing a lot of transactions in this space. What are some of the, why has debt become so popular? And I mean, is it really more popular than equity today?
Yeah, great. So I think just before we talk about, the debt structures, I think important to understand what are the typical kind of challenges that people were facing in deal making which this structure is addressing. One challenge, at least in the M&A space, used to be, can I really borrow, from external sources, from abroad, for the purpose of acquiring shares? The challenge was that Indian exchange control regulations did not allow it because foreign debt typically qualified as what we call as external commercial borrowings, which could only be used for capital expenditures and was not permitted to be used for the purpose of acquisition of shares. That was one challenge which people faced in terms of, in terms of getting leverage for, from foreign sources for the purpose of acquisition of shares. The other challenge people faced in terms of deal making in the private equity space in what we call as asset-heavy asset classes, like real estate, infrastructure, sometimes in healthcare, like, hospitals or other asset classes, where there is constant income which keeps coming in into the company, and that income or that cash flow needs to be distributed to the investors. Now, unlike, many of the economies abroad, in India, one challenge that we face is of how do we distribute returns to the investors or to the shareholder. Because whenever in India, any income has to be distributed, typically it is, first you pay corporate income tax of about 30% on the income that you receive, and then on distributions, there is an additional tax at the issuer company level on the dividends that are distributed, which is in the nature of about 15%. Or if you do a buyback, then an additional tax of about 20%. This tax is not even generally creditable in the hands of the recipient because it is not a tax, it is not a withholding tax. It is an additional tax paid by the issuer company. Therefore, in many of the sectors like infrastructure, real estate, etc., the challenge was that how do we distribute? Because if there is no debt or there is no expense which is happening, there is a clear leakage of about 40-45% kind of taxes. And the way Indian exchange control regulations really worked is that a non-resident could really only invest into an Indian company by way of equity or securities compulsorily convertible into equity. That was the other challenge. The third challenge, people faced many times was that, in sectors like insurance or retail, there is a sectoral gap, right? So you want to invest into insurance sector, but there is a 49% cap, and that also beyond 26%, you need FIPB approval, etc., which may or may not come through. So you are really restricted in your ability to invest, right? So let's understand, how is this listed bond or the NCD structure, how is it helping in some of these challenges? So this, what happened in 2008, for the first time, the Indian government kind of realized that we are having a buoyant or whatever equity capital market, but there were really no debt capital markets, right? Globally, about 40% of the debt needs are met by corporate bonds, but in India, that proportion was only about 3.5 to 4%. So they said, we need to simplify the bond listing regime to encourage people to not go to banks all the time, but really subscribe, but really raise money through corporate bonds. And therefore, in 2008, they issued what we call as a simplified debt issue regulations, right? Under this debt issue regulations, any Indian company today can issue bonds to a non-resident. The bonds need to be listed, but the listing process has been made so simple, it is no way as complicated as equity. In fact, we have had situations where we had filed for listing in the morning and got the approval by the evening. And the listing disclosures are today not that difficult because the new companies that anyways requires you to make substantial disclosures, and the disclosures which you will be making under this kind of listing of the bonds is not really much more different than you would otherwise be making. So the disclosures are also not onerous. Once these bonds are listed, any non-resident, you know, you will need to be a qualified non-resident to purchase these bonds. So that registration process has also been substantially deregulated in the past couple of years. Today, almost any individual or any company which is not regulated, not a broad-based fund, anyone can really register as what we call as a foreign portfolio investor category 3 and subscribe to these bonds. Now, what is the benefit? Now, these bonds are structured in such a way that, one, there is an interest component, and two, there is a redemption premium component. Your interest component can be as low as 0%, and it can only have a redemption premium component, and the redemption premium of the bond can be linked to the cash flows in the company, right? So in that sense, it can work like a structured equity instrument. So you can invest into a company by way of a structured bond or by way of this kind of listed bond and link it to the cash flows of the company. So let's say it's a healthcare company, right? It's into real estate or infrastructure or multi-brand retail or anything, you know. Cash income keeps coming in, and your returns are really on the bond. The redemption premium is really a function of how much money is coming into the company. Now, the benefit here is that when a company pays returns by the redemption premium as against by way of dividend, it is straight away saving on the 45% tax. Because not only is it saving there, it is that because whatever redemption premium the company pays will be a tax deductible at the hands of the company. So there is no corporate tax levy. In fact, you're reducing your profitable income, right? So you are having a massive tax saving in structuring returns. And in fact, you would realize, in fact, by numbers, 75% of the deals in asset heavy, or what we call as, you know, real assets, you know, real estate, infrastructure, and some of these, and hospitals, etc., happened by way of these bonds in 2014. The other benefit of the bond is that there is no end-use restriction. So as I said, leveraged, you know, getting foreign leverage, etc., if there's a challenge, ECB, there is a problem, but these bonds do not qualify as external commercial borrowing because they're under the listed route. So therefore, there is no end-use restriction. You can use as much debt as you want and use it for the purpose of acquisition of shares or whatever you want to do. There is absolutely no problem. Third benefit is from the perspective of investing into sectors that are restricted. So we have done deals in the insurance space, right, or into, you know, many of the other restricted sectors. Because this bond is not falling under what we call as foreign direct investment, you can really invest. So, you know, you could have a component of 26%, let's say, by way of equity, but you can still draw out by way of redemption premium returns up to 74% also into insurance or retail where you would not be able to do it otherwise, under a pure equity or an FDI structure, you know, as we call it. From a tax perspective, let's understand how this is different. So one is that there is a, whatever you pay out is a deductible for the Indian company. On the interest or the redemption premium, there will be a withholding tax, provided that, you know, everyone is regarding this as interest income. There will be a withholding tax which will need to be paid, which in case of Singapore is 15%, which in case of Netherlands is 10%, which in case of US is again 15%. And this withholding tax, because it's a withholding tax, is typically always creditable at the hands of the recipient, unlike dividends where you may or may not get credit. So therefore, from a recipient perspective, it doesn't really make difference. You are paying a tax here, but it is ultimately you are getting credit in your home jurisdiction. So from a tax perspective also, it makes perfect sense. Another small benefit is that under normal equity structures, you are not permitted to create any kind of security interest. And what is happening is that in India, sometimes promoters get greedy, sometimes promoters get cute, and what might happen is that, you know, because you don't have teeth and you're pure equity investors, you're not even allowed to have any kind of assured returns, right? And many times private equity investors do not want assured returns, but they want an exit at a certain exit horizon, let's say after 4 or 5 years. Now, how do you do that, right? So what this bond allows you is comfort, one, in terms of creation of security interest. So through an onshore security trustee, you can create security interest. Second is it allows you to have whatever assured return, because this is really a bond in that sense, so there is no problem. And third challenge which you, in fact, the larger challenge which you face in the Indian context is how do you retire equity? Because capital repatriation is a huge challenge. You either do it by way of buyback, where you cannot do it more than 25% in each year, and that too only if you have you know, reserves and all of it, or you have to go to the court. Here, whatever repatriation you do will be under the automatic route. So it gives you security creation benefits, equity-like returns, no FDI restrictions, and all those benefits. In fact, there is a green book which all of you might have. It says private equity and private debt in India. So it talks about the private debt structures also and some of the typical challenges which you also face in private equity from a tax and a regulatory standpoint.
One quick question on that. There has been a use of the NBFC platform as well. How does that, I mean, are there any specific advantages as far as pure debt is concerned, NCD versus having an NBFC, non-banking finance company platform onshore in India? Because that's also become quite popular.
Yeah.
Could you just share 2 minutes on that?
So NBFC platforms are again becoming very popular. You know, India is a high-yield economy. You would be surprised, but a 24% return in India is also considered arm's length in certain places. You know, and unsecured lending has even happened at 28%. And 24% is considered okay in certain sectors, right? So it would be unheard of in some of the other economies. So therefore, lending is gaining tremendous credence in India. Now, and what happens is that banks in India are extremely restricted. So there is an official, you know, so there's a diktat from the RBI that, you know, you cannot invest more than X amount or a very small amount into real estate or more than X amount into, you know, for the purpose of capital market acquisitions. And even, you know, even software companies today do not get, you know, they are unable to get loans from the banks because of the exposure limits. So NBFCs are really capturing that niche segment where funding is not available from banks, and their NBFCs are able to fund at, you know, at a good rate. And therefore, what is happening is that a lot of these foreign players who are into the yield space, you know, or the fixed income space are actually setting up Indian NBFC platforms. And there is always a debate, you know, whether I should set up for the purpose of domestic lending, whether I should set up a NBFC, or I can directly lend by way of NCDs. That debate continues to, you know, continues to grow. But if you are really looking at a sustained lending platform in India, obviously NBFC is the way to go, because then the portfolio company doesn't need to list those bonds, and there are, you know, it's an operational ease. And then, you know, and there's someone at home kind of taking on the ground charge of the things. But otherwise, you know, even offshore lending directly by way of NCDs is equally prevalent.
Okay, we'll ask you one last question on stressed assets. Again, that there is a growing market in India for distressed and stressed assets. A lot of, I believe, a lot of special situation funds are being set up to cash in on this emerging trend. A minute or two on what's happening there.
So I think, Steve, what was happening was that, and this story about Indian banks not enforcing securities, even when the assets have become non-performing for many, many years, is not unknown to many of these, you know, is not unknown. The Kingfisher saga is probably one of those examples which kind of raised a lot of doubt, and the RBI governor said that you could not be sitting on debt when it became non-performing for so many years, and yet seeing your Indian businesses actually, you know, become, you know, absolutely meltdown. So therefore, there was a need felt by the government to inculcate a more, strong regime, and a regime that does not wait for the asset to become non-performing. So even before the asset becomes non-performing, banks must start acting. And therefore, they brought in the concept of joint lenders forum, wherein banks must start identifying assets Not when a business is a not performing asset, that means company has not paid anything to you for 90 days, 180 days, and then you are acting. But really, when the first signs of non-performing assets come up, that is, if interest has not been paid within 30 days, even then your account becomes stressed, you know, and the bank should start identifying this. And there is no choice for the banks. Banks mandatorily have to do it now, right? So there is no discretion left that, oh, there is NPA, whether I'll enforce, not enforce, and the only pressure is not really provisioning norms in your balance sheet. The issue is much more than that, that you must identify that asset, you must report any kind of stressed asset to a central repository of information, and you must then take absolute and corrective actions to initiate recovery. And what are those actions? So you can say there are a couple of actions that you've been provided that, you know, you can restructure and all, but one of the critical parts which has been, which has been provided for is that the banks will be permitted to convert their debt into equity, such that banks become a majority owner of the equity of the company, because that's really the strongest. There is nothing more than equity ownership. No form of security interest can replace ownership of the company. And for that, they have made changes. So they have kind of changed the regulations to allow that when the bank is converting its debt into equity, preferential allotment, etc., you know, those rules have been relaxed. Now, when the bank is holding equity, bank is not in the business of holding equity or running the company. Bank will obviously be selling that amount of equity to other people, and there is already electro-steel, etc., which is in the market, which is happening. When the bank has to sell that equity, you know, we see a substantial amount of interest from private equity players and other strategic players, you know, who would be willing to buy that majority equity stake. And that is where I think, yes, there are certain teething problems, because open offer, etc., you know, requirements, when a promoter will, you know, when a new strategic buyer or a, you know, the B, but, you know, the special situation fund will buy the majority, there is, he will have to make an open offer, and that may not be always ideal for him. So those kind of teething problems have to be issued, you know, have to be resolved. But this kind of benefit where a bank by default has to identify the stressed asset, will have to convert into 51% equity, and then will have to sell, will, I think, resolve a majority of the issues where banks were kept sitting on non-performing assets, and at the same time will allow majority of these P-players, etc., because there's substantial leverage in Indian companies. So, you know, that is another way where I think a lot of value will be unlocked.
Thanks so much, Ruchir. That was very insightful. I'll quickly ask Mahesh in maybe 5 minutes, 5 minutes time now, to touch upon what's happening in the India-Mauritius tax treaty. As you all know, India and Mauritius are in heated negotiations right now to renegotiate the tax treaty, a tax treaty which has, for a number of years, contributed to about 48% of all foreign investment in India. That 48% still comes through Mauritius. So it's a very important jurisdiction as far as FDI is concerned. But there is a discussion which is reaching what we believe quite a final stage. So could you throw some light on what you think, what have you heard is going to happen, and does that have any impact on Singapore? Because from what I understand, the Singapore-India tax treaty is linked to the survival of the India-Mauritius tax treaty. And if one goes, the other falls as well. So maybe if you could just throw some light on
that. Sure. Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, this is probably one of the hottest topics, and is, at least when it comes to India, and it impacts all structures for India, right? Whereas Vivek said, because 40% FDI through Mauritius, around 15% through Singapore, right? And if anything happens to the Mauritius treaty, it impacts the Singapore treaty as well. So what we are talking about, this, the capital gains exemption for Mauritius companies, if that goes, then the exemption would not be available to Singapore companies as well, right? So that's why it's a very important topic, all eyes on this issue. What we are hearing is that today Mauritius treaty does not have what we call the substance requirement, right, which is there in the Singapore treaty. So in Singapore, for a Singapore-based company to take advantage of the treaty, it has to incur $200,000 expenditure in Singapore and operational expenditure for 2 years prior to the sale of shares, right? So this is a substance requirement. Once the Singapore company satisfies that, then it is deemed not to be a conduit, right? So it should be entitled to treaty relief. So then it essentially adds an element of certainty, but at the same time it adds an element of cost. Right, so that's why, because of this substance requirement in Singapore, even today, several companies have several structures, strategic P guys have been using Mauritius because in terms of managing costs and things like that. But now, because of these ongoing renegotiation of the treaty, there's a possibility that a similar substance requirement will figure in the Mauritius treaty as well. And but again, that the thresholds may be different. It may be lower than $200,000. We're not sure of what's ultimately going to happen. Now again, the ultimate outcome of this negotiation is the idea is to ensure that there's full certainty for investors. Right? Because yes, the tax department may want to remove this capital gains exemption. But at the same time, there's so many non-tax and strategic issues involved in this India-Mauritius discussion. Okay, so India and Mauritius have a lot of strategic economic ties, and so it's not possible to just remove this exemption overnight, right? So and that's relevant for Singapore as well, because if that exemption is removed in Mauritius, then the exemption not available for Singapore companies, right? So that's why we're hoping that in the next month or so we get a draft of this. What they call the limitation of benefits criteria, the substance criteria in the treaty, in the Mauritius treaty, a draft of that to be shared, and hopefully that gets resolved, and it should hopefully ensure certainty for investors.
I think just to add to what Mahesh said, I think between Singapore and Mauritius debate, one of the jurisdictions which has been gaining prominence for investing into India is Netherlands. We have been using Netherlands a lot to invest into India. Netherlands, India has an excellent tax treaty, both for debt and equity. So while Mauritius and Singapore are fighting with each other, Netherlands is slowly gaining ground and attracting a lot of investors, especially, as Ruchir mentioned, a lot of investments post-2009, which is when we had the global meltdown, have been in the form of debt as compared to equity. And for debt, Netherlands is better even as compared to Singapore, because the withholding tax rate on interest is only 10% as compared to 15% under the India-Singapore tax treaty. So just to we have actually set up 3-4 structures in Netherlands in the last couple of years, and those structures have been working out quite well. There we haven't faced any major issues on those structures. So just as I mentioned, Netherlands has been doing great in the last couple of years.
Yeah, in fact, for both debt and equity also, to a certain extent. So if it's portfolio investments, that structures work pretty well, right? Because as long as the investment is below 10%, then again it's the gains are exempt. So not only have the low 10% withholding tax rate, but your capital gains is also exempt if you use the debt structure and your holding is lesser than 10%. Which means Netherlands becomes as good as Mauritius, Singapore for equity, plus you have the interest advantage. Plus, in the Mauritius treaty, as part of the renegotiation, apart from the substance provision, limitation of benefits, they're also likely to add a interest benefit, so on withholding tax. So probably something on the lines of Singapore, where Singapore has reduced withholding tax from around 42% in India to 15%, right? So something similar may also figure in Mauritius. It will be quite interesting, because then going forward, assuming that we have certainty on the capital gains side, Mauritius may also be used for in their structures.
Yeah. Thanks. So I think we are seeing Mauritius and Singapore probably coming to a bit of a more of a level playing field. It looks like that, but when governments are negotiating, one doesn't know what happens in the end. But at least our gut feel is that there'll be a bit of a level playing field, and maybe Netherlands, as you pointed out, and Netherlands, in fact, it domestically has some very great, unique types of entities that can be used for these structures, which don't even exist in Mauritius and Singapore. So something to watch out for and maybe to take into consideration in your next structures. We have about 5 to 7 minutes before we hit Q&A and before we go, and then we go for our high tea, which I'm sure all of you are waiting for. I am. So Ankit, very quickly, in 3 to 4 minutes, there are new insider trading regulations in India. Now, again, I know that I've been hearing they're fairly restrictive. There are interpretation issues. Could you throw some quick light on what these regulations are and why should people here be interested in knowing about them?
Yeah. I think there's been a lot of discussion on the new insider trading regulations, which came into effect in the month of May this year. And this is nothing new to India. I think globally, after the entire U.S. mortgage crisis, you had a tightening of insider trading laws, and it's happened globally, and India is no exception to that. I think just one from an M&A PE perspective, just on a couple of minutes, I'll take on that. And the key point to note is, under the old regime, doing a diligence was difficult because there was an interpretation issue on whether an acquirer could in fact conduct due diligence on the target, which was based on information which was not available in the public domain. The new regulations specifically address that issue, and it allows the acquirer to conduct a due diligence if the acquirer is making an open offer, or if the board is of the opinion that the offer is in the best interest of the company. Now, this is an exception to the general rule that is there under the current code, which is you can't communicate, procure, or deal in securities based on unpublished price-sensitive information. So this acts as exception to that rule, and therefore, it should allow acquirers to conduct a due diligence on the target. But there are a lot of issues surrounding this because the exception puts the ball back into the court of the directors. That is, the directors have to decide before sharing such UPSI for diligence purposes, whether it's in the interest of the company or not. There is always the potential issue of whether there could be a suit by a shareholder stating that, the director provided the information when the offer was not in the best interest of the company. The other issue is, how do you even give an offer to the board for the board to evaluate without you conducting a diligence? So those are potential issues. From a private equity standpoint, the other issue is if you're having a nominee director, then how does the nominee director sort of bring back the information from the portfolio company to the fund? And, there are certain restrictions on that. So those are a few considerations that one needs to think through based on the new code, that's come into being. Now, having heard all the issues I've spoken about, I am sure that you'll go back and probably evaluate. The Ruchir has been very persuasive in establishing that debt is a much better option than equity. Now, hearing all these issues, I fear that you'll probably, think India is not the greatest place to do equity investments. But that is not the case. All issues are there. They're globally as well, but none of them are insurmountable.
Thanks, Ankit. I think lastly, Nishchal, maybe we wrap up with you. We have a new Companies Act. We have a number of new provisions in that which deal with corporate governance, shareholder activism, the role of the board. Where does India stand with respect to other developed markets, more mature markets, as far as its corporate governance mechanism is concerned?
Sure. So, in fact, there was a survey conducted by McKinsey & Company on private equity investments into India. And since 2000, in the last 15 years, about $93 billion of private equity investments have been made in India. And that has been one of the major reasons why the corporate governance standards of some of the private equity-backed companies have substantially improved. Because all the PE investors ensure that, certain processes are followed, their global standards which they follow for other global portfolio companies are followed by the Indian promoters. So that's one of welcome change which we have seen in the last, decade or so, where private equity investors have been able to bring substantial change in the way the Indian companies are run. Second important thing which we have seen in the last 10 to 15 years is the shift of control from promoters or substantial shareholders to the board. Like in the US and other developed markets, the role of the board is more important than the role of the substantial shareholders. And same is the thing which we have been seeing in the last few years in India too, where even the regulators have geared up to ensure that the laws are drafted in a manner where the board members are always on the hook in case something wrong happens with the governance structure of the company. The classic cases being the recent insider trading regulations which Ankit talked about. The board of the company is required to take a call whether allowing a particular bidder to conduct diligence on the company is in the best interest of the company or not. because that bidder may also get certain price sensitive information about the company which the other public shareholders do not have. So that's a big, big responsibility which has been cast on the board to take a call on whether the bidder is the right person to acquire stake in the company. The second place where we see the role of the board increasing is takeover code, where again the independent directors who sit on the board of the company, they have been given the responsibility of evaluating the offers in case there are multiple offers which have been received for acquisition of stake of the listed company. And they need to take a call on which offer is better and in the best interest of the stakeholders. Companies Act, again, we have a new Companies Act, what we call 2013 Companies Act, which is only partially effective. A lot of provisions are still not effective. So right now we are juggling between the two acts. Certain provisions of 1956 Companies Act are effective and certain provisions of 2013 Companies Act are effective. But the new Companies Act, there is a specific section 166, which clearly codifies the duties of a director of a company. And it clearly brings out the fact that the director has to act in a diligent manner to protect the interest of the stakeholders. So the directors of an Indian listed company especially, they are constantly watched by not only the regulators, but even there are now shareholder activists agencies which are slowly coming up. In fact, there are three shareholder advisory service agencies which keep on evaluating each and every extraordinary general meeting minutes which are extraordinary general meeting resolutions which are circulated, and they evaluate whether the particular decision which is being taken is in the best interest of the company or not. And based on their advice, at times large shareholders vote in the general meetings. So there is a constant watch on what the promoters are doing with respect to the listed companies. In fact, we have seen number of cases in the last 1 or 2 years on shareholder activism. The classic case was, Holcim Group was getting a cash out of about $600 million from one of its subsidiaries without paying the public shareholders. So there was a lot of hue and cry from public shareholders that a 60% shareholder is getting indirectly dividend, which the 40% public shareholders are not getting. So although nothing much happened after that, but at least it was widely discussed in the newspapers and in the print media on how can a promoter take money out without paying the public shareholder. Similarly, in Tata Group, which is one of the most reputed groups of India, the shareholders denied the increase in compensation to one of the board members just because they were not very comfortable with the performance of that particular board member. So a lot of things are evolving. One of the other things which we have also been seeing is slowly the hostile takeover we are also seeing happening. Although India still does not have the culture of hostile takeovers, but at the same time, we have been seeing one or two hostile takeover attempts being made every year. And the law clearly permits hostile takeovers in India. So under the law, there is no bar on an acquirer conducting a hostile takeover. And last but not the least, under the new Companies Act, we also have a class action suit remedy, which is available. Although that section is still not effective, but once that section is effective, again, it's going to result in, much better governance in the Indian company.
Thanks, Nishal. So I think we end our panel discussion on that note of corporate governance and the kind of developments that are happening. I think it's now time for questions. We have people who have joined us on the phone and all of you here. So please ask any questions that you may have, so that then we can proceed outside for some tea. Will?
Could I just ask a tax question?
Sure.
If I could just give you a hypothetical situation, just to get some feedback from an Indian tax advisor's perspective. If you imagine there's a Singapore target, it has a big operation relative to the size of the overall business in India. And you do due diligence on the target. the tax advisors on the due diligence say there's a big exposure to Indian tax in this target company because permanent establishment, only withholding tax is being paid, but actually there's a, you know, exposure to tax at 47%. And can you structure your way out of that issue by saying, okay, what we will do is we'll buy the business. We won't buy the company which has the tax liability. We will just buy the business, and then we'll carry on the business in a new company, and we'll leave the target company behind to deal with this problem. Is that a solution?
Yeah, so just a few comments on that. So the way you would normally see it is the Singapore company would have, let's say, a subsidiary in India under it, which would have a business and potentially a lot of these tax liabilities, right? Because there are various levels of tax exposures. One is the historic tax liabilities of the target and especially their subsidiary in India, right? And then deal-related tax liabilities in terms of withholding tax. So you're talking about the historic liability, right?
Actually, there's no subsidiary. There's, you know, people have been there, but there's been no subsidiary. So the due diligence is saying there's an exposure to tax as a permanent establishment in India on the target company.
So one is if there is a liability which is attached to the company, then clearly the business transfer which you mentioned is one of the options which is available. And in fact, not only tax liability, a lot of times what we have seen, there are other liabilities which the company is sitting on which the acquirer doesn't want to take over. In that situation, business transfer is the best option because you are only taking over the business and leaving the liabilities with the seller. So to that extent, you are getting a clean asset and let the seller deal with the liabilities which, you know, he has historically acquired. So to that extent, that is one model. If for any reason the business transfer is not possible, then we have also seen escrow and holdback structure where depending on the resolution of the tax litigation which is going on, the monies are released either to the seller or to the buyer. So these are the two ways in which you can handle these type of issues.
There's one small...
You mentioned advance rulings.
Yeah.
Do you see deals being done? You talked about indemnities and advance rulings and so on. Do you see deals being done where you go on historical issues to the tax authority?
No, for an advance ruling, you can seek an advance ruling on a prior transaction, but in your own case, right, this is a historic tax exposure of the target. The target could have sought an advance ruling, but at that relevant point in time, right? So advance ruling may not be an option here, but it could be relevant for the acquisition, saying that, because with an advance ruling, you have the opportunity to create the best facts now, which work for you, right? So let's say you structure it in a manner that you are hiving off this part of the business outside India, and then you are acquiring that, right? And the seller of that business is, let's say, a Singapore company. You take advantage of the treaty. You go to the advance ruling authority, put all these facts and say that there should be no tax liability on this, and they confirm that. But they will not be able to give a confirmation for the historic issues.
Yeah, and
right.
Also, if the matter is already going on
with
any level of tax authority, then you cannot take advance ruling.
If it is currently being scrutinized.
Yeah.
And on this hiving off, there's a slight complication. If let's say it's not at the Singapore level, it's at the India level. Because at the Singapore level, the business hiving off business assets, because many of them are not very asset heavy. So at least in many of the structures where you also have Indian operations, right? And let's say you have an Indian subsidiary, and there are a lot of historical tax issues which you find the diligence. Now there is a bit of a challenge to just let's say spin off these assets. And then say that you are acquiring these assets. Because sometimes there is an element of successor liability. And also if there are...
That's what I'm worried about.
Yeah, so that liability is there if it's an Indian company, very clearly. But if it's at a Singapore level, technically that does not really apply. The successor liability issues do not. So you have more flexibility in taking the assets out of the Singapore company. But I'm not sure how many cases one would encounter that kind of... Because in most of these acquisitions, you have a Singapore entity. You have some operation on the ground. But most of the assets may be in India. Right, most of the with an Indian subsidiary. Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
I mean, in this case, the easiest way to handle would be if the tax liability is attached to the Indian company, do a business transfer from the Indian company to the acquirer's Indian subsidiary, sell the shares of the Indian company to the promoter, and then transfer the Singapore company to the acquirer. So the acquirer acquires Singapore company and the business of the Indian company. The Indian company remains with the seller.
Okay, thank you. Also a tax question. Who said tax is dry, right? Rocio, you mentioned the structured bonds, the corporate bonds, and even to the extent that they are structured in such a way that there's no interest component and everything is basically repatriated as a premium. Being a Dutch tax lawyer, also involved in these kinds of debt transactions, I was wondering, do you have the notion of requalifying interest into debt? Because that's something that we know, and you know, if you're a creditor and you have those kinds of profit rights, you might be considered to actually be engaged and have the economic ownership of the debtor.
So from a tax perspective, we would be having general entire avoidance rules, which will be kicking in only post 2017. And technically, all the investments that you do prior, the tax authorities do not have the power to recharacterize, because right now the regime that we have is form over substance. Post GAR, it might, it will become substance over form, but before 2017, if you make an investment, it will be grandfathered. And at this point in time, the tax authorities technically do not have the right to recharacterize based on certain notion that, it is working like equity, so it is, so debt should be equity. But you can never rule out the tax authorities raising questions. But if it actually goes on to litigation, I think the tax authorities do not have the power to recharacterize. In fact, what we also suggest is that, as a safety or as a precaution, take enough support. So, you could actually go ahead and get a term sheet from an NBFC or from some other lender, which would actually show that the loan that was coming out to you was at 20%, but with this kind of a redemption premium based on the waterfall, you would actually end up, let's say, at about, around 21, 22, So it would depend on the base, on the particular facts. But the argument that we'll need to further on to the tax authorities is that it is my commercial decision, how do I structure my loan? It can be a function where I'm giving a fixed coupon every year, or it can be a function where the lender is saying that don't pay me on a fixed rate, but pay me, let's say, at the end of fifth year, every sixth year, or as and when your profits accrete. So that's really a commercial function. Today, that debate, I don't think the tax authorities have the power to recharacterize debt into equity, so whatever you will pay will typically be characterized as debt only, and the redemption premium will be an expense.
Now, also, we do not have thin capitalization rules in India, like, developed countries have. So the tax authorities cannot recharacterize interest into dividend if the debt equity ratio is above a certain threshold. So we don't have that threshold concept of thin capitalization rules. So currently, we have seen structures where it's, even 99-1 ratio, where the debt is 99 and 1 is equity. And till date, just based on the debt equity ratio, there has been no disallowance or recharacterization with the tax authorities at that.
Okay, but if I understand correctly, once the GAR has kicked in, there is a legal basis to recharacterize. So these structured bonds, these kinds of instruments, you will have to watch out for that.
Yeah, so essentially it's about having proper commercial justification and ensuring it's at arm's length. As long as you can do that, you still have a reasonable basis to defend even once GAR comes into force. Right? So as Richard was saying, if you, while structuring the terms of your bond, if you take other benchmarks, what another NBFC is using and something on par, right? Plus, wherever possible, document all these commercial reasons why it is structured this way. Because it's not tax. Tax is one of the 10 reasons why we are structuring it in this manner, right? You need to capture those 9 other reasons. Because once you're able to demonstrate that the main driver of this structure is not a tax benefit, we should still be able to defend against GAR.
And also, I think, just to add, there have been prior case laws where it has been set out that, any redemption premium or any payout on a bond up to an arm's length is typically interest. Beyond that arm's length is typically disallowed as interest. And beyond that arm's length is where I think the tax authorities can raise a question of recharacterizing it, right? And that's when the nature might change from interest to capital gains or dividends if they recharacterize it or disallowance is quite certain. But till arm's length, at least there is not an issue. The benefit for you only is that in India, the arm's length is very high. So we can look around that.
Thank you. Yes, thanks so much. My question is also for Richard, but anyone else can also chip in. So you mentioned equity and debt in the instruments in between. I want to ask if you're seeing any amount of venture debt, which is a form of financing that's available to early stage companies which don't have either positive cash flows or significant tangible assets that you can therefore secure. And they're not open to traditional bank financing either. Venture debt is, I'm not sure to what extent it can be done with such in India, but Silicon Valley Bank, which is now called InnoVen Capital, has just been
acquired. It's happening. Yeah, it's happening. There are a couple of those strictly venture debt platforms or vehicles which have been set up, which are purely doing that in very small tranches, mostly as domestic vehicles, not really offshore. So the domestic vehicle is in turn getting like an NBFC, is actually getting money from offshore entities by way of NCD into the NBFC, and the NBFC in turn is doing this. But it's very small. And the challenge also is that, you cannot pay more than arm's length, because one, it can be disallowed, and secondly, it can be recharacterized at a later point in time. Of course, you can get security benefits and all, but it doesn't really help much in context of venture companies.
Yeah. In fact, InnoVen is an NBFC model. There is also one other fund called Trifecta.
Yeah.
They have set themselves up as a Category 2 debt AIF, and what they do is venture debt. So they have marketed their fund as venture debt, and they are on, I think they should be doing the first close anytime. But this is an interesting sweet spot which is there between venture equity and pure debt, where venture debt, especially InnoVen, which are SVB, we had done a lot of deals for them. This is a classic issue with most of the service companies. They don't have any asset to offer, but at the same time they have potential. So banks do not usually lend, and that's why Silicon Valley Bank was able to garner most of the market share in the venture debt space, and this is becoming an interesting product for a lot of GPs, and a lot of them are evaluating raising funds based on this model. One more question. Maybe I think one question, and then we can take it offline.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to ask whether, this debt structure and mechanism is used also to overcome perhaps like regulatory restrictions in terms of foreign interests in a company in India, for example. And if so, how do the authorities in India look at, for example, where as part of your debt structure, you actually then put as a condition of the lending, management control and that kind of mechanism, where does India go with that?
Yeah. So, as I said, obviously, because this is, let's not call it debt structure, right? We need to differentiate based on the regime that we have. So the restrictions which you're talking about are under the foreign direct investment regime. Those restrictions do not conceptually apply to investment made under the foreign portfolio investment regime. When you're investing into listed equity, you do not comply with sectoral restrictions like you're investing into retail, right? It's a listed retail company. Those restrictions do not apply to you, right? So the distinction is not really on debt versus equity, right, conceptually. The distinction is really on the basis of regime. The way regulations are worded is there is a transfer issue of securities to a person resident outside India regime under what we call as Foreign Exchange Management Act, FEMA in India. There is one schedule which particularly deals with equity or instruments convertible into equity, which is called foreign direct investment regime. Right? There is a completely independent schedule which deals with foreign portfolio investments into listed securities, because listed securities conceptually are meant to be portfolio investments, which means there is not, you're not controlling that entity, right? And control can be as subjective as you can think it to be, but so long as you're not having day-to-day control, it will still be portfolio investment, and therefore FDI conditionalities will not apply. Now, my foreign portfolio investment regime allows me two kind of investments. One is debt investment, one is equity investment, both of which will not be subjected to the FDI conditionalities. What we are talking about is a foreign portfolio investment into debt securities. These securities are listed, but they are privately placed. So, yes, there may be one investor or maybe only two investors in that entire listed issuance, but that is what the regime is allowing me today. So if I go back to the history, the first ever debt deal was done by us, 2008. You know, it was into a company which was kind of doing real estate, and that company was not meeting the thresholds of real estate investments because of certain sectoral conditionalities. When we were kind of just about finished doing that deal, Economic Times ran a front page story that foreign debt entering into guy's rules and all that, you know. And all of a sudden what happened is that all the regulators and all the stock exchange got very apprehensive that, you know, what is this huge structure? We don't understand this. So we had done just one prior to that in terms of, it was a healthcare company we were tracking, it was promoter funding we were tracking returns and all that. But this being real estate was a little closer to the hearts, you know, because real estate is like the sacred cow sector for the Indian regulator. So it came up in news. Then what we had to do, the Bombay Stock Exchange, where most of these debt instruments were listed, said, you know, you're doing something really cute, we'll not list it. So Bombay Stock Exchange ultimately then conceded that we are only service providers, we are not regulators, we are not concerned with what the instrument is. From a SEBI standpoint, a securities regulator in India, he said that this is on private placement basis, our mandate is really to regulate the retail public interest, and so long as we're doing this within the contours of the debt issue regulations, which we have only issued, we are fine. And we were complying with that. The third perspective, which came up, was from an RBI perspective. And RBI said, we have anyways amended the schedule, right? So the regulations anyways are giving you the permission to do debt in whatever way you want. There is no, if there had to be a cap, right? Like if you do compulsorily convertible debentures in India, which happens under FDI route, you know, under Schedule 1, as I was saying, there is a cap that you cannot pay more than 17% interest. If that had to be the intent, that intent had to be incorporated into this regulation also, but there is no such intent, so there is no interest cap. So they clearly allowed. Another comfort for the regulator is that overall, for the entire economy, there is a $51 billion cap on these kind of bond instruments. So the government is comfortable that it is happening within that overall cap, you're not exceeding that. And third comfort that the government gets is that these are all rupee denominated. So the currency risk is actually on the foreign investor, not on the Indian investor. And it's actually, you know, the RBI has gone again to say that we want to also, because foreign inflow, right, or forex inflow, source cannot be just foreign equity inflow. Foreign debt inflows will also probably be a significant source of inflow, and that is why the withholding rate on these bonds has been reduced from, 20% to 5%. What more comfort can you get where the revenue is clashing the tax rates, right? So we've gone through the entire regulatory curve, and that's where we stand. And most of the deals which have happened, in fact, in the course of last year also, have all been structured returns, where the redemption premium is always built in. It is a function of the cash flows or a function of any other variable. So we've gone through that, and I think there is a reasonable amount of comfort that it's okay.
Yeah. Thanks, Vijay. Anyone on the phone would like to ask a question?
Sure, sir. I'll make an announcement right away.
Yeah, please do that.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will begin the question and answer session for the audio participants. If you have any questions, you may press star and one on the touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to use only handset while asking questions. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. Audio participants, if you have any questions, you may press star and one. We have our first question from the line of Amit Rathi from Unitas. Please go ahead.
Hi. This is a question with regard to the fact that from an investment, let's say from a Mauritius company where it sells out an investment in Indian equity, Indian company, given the fact that there's an India and Mauritius tax treaty, for example. But then there was this old regulation and kind of clarified in the recent budget as well, is that if there is indirect holding with more than 50% of operations in India, which is significant operations in India, then it gets taxed in India. I just want to understand, how does it work? With, if it's Mauritius, can I take the shield, or government can still go come to me saying that, you know what, 50% of operations is in India, so I'll tax you in India. So just wanted some help on that.
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question very briefly? It's on indirect transfer, right? That's what we could hear. There's some slight distortion in the line.
So the question is, if Mauritius Company A buys out Mauritius Company B, and by the way, the Mauritius Company B had investment in an Indian company, so there is an indirect transfer, so to say.
And where is the seller?
The seller is again in Mauritius.
Right.
So can I claim India Mauritius DTA, or government can say that, look here, this is an indirect transfer of an Indian asset, please pay that.
Yeah, so this is a typical indirect transfer scenario, but because of the Mauritius treaty, and again, for the benefit of the audience, the question is, Mauritius seller sells a Mauritius company to a Mauritius buyer, and the Mauritius target has underlying assets in India, right? So this is an indirect acquisition, indirect transfer, where you're transferring a Mauritius company, but indirectly transferring the Indian company, and then there is potential tax liability in India, but because of the Mauritius tax treaty, seller takes advantage of that, and there is no tax liability. So that's why the treaty relief is very important while structuring around this indirect transfer issue, or they call the Vodafone tax issue. Right? Does that address your question?
Yeah, that addresses. So it's in case it was a different regime, it might have been open, but given the Indian Mauritius...
Yes, Mauritius, definitely. And apart from Mauritius, there are several treaties which allow us to get around the indirect transfer issue. Although it may not allow us to get around the direct transfer issue, we can potentially get around the indirect transfer issue using several treaties. US, UK not being one of them.
Thank you. That's helpful.
I think we are out of time now. So if anybody on the phone or anyone else has any questions, email or offline outside. Thank you, everyone. And let's now head to the foyer for some tea.